Welcome, welcome, welcome to episode 3 of Life Without Consequence, a novel in the form of an audiobook that is posing as a podcast. I continue to be Davey Francis, your host, narrator, and creator of this unusual thing that you have chosen to indulge in. If this is your first time joining us, then I'll reiterate what I said last episode. Stop, for the love of God. Go and listen to the previous episodes. There is really only one jumping on point here, and it's episode 1. For those of you that are caught up, let's recap. Our heroes, Parker and Benj, have witnessed their neighbor Mad Mike commit suicide, an event that has caused a chain reaction of bad luck for our main characters. It brought the police down on them, which ruined their illegal distillery, and it threw Parker and his girlfriend Nina's relationship into turmoil. All is not lost, though. It seems that Mad Mike left behind a strange device that appears to be some sort of teleporter. Despite destroying their fridge and briefly kidnapping a child from North Korea, Parker and Benj are confident they can use this device to their benefit. Before we get back into the story, I just want to shout out and thank everyone listening. In particular, I want to thank the Patreon subscribers, and even more in particular, I'd like to thank the producers like Hampus. It's you guys who are helping me get closer and closer to turning this strange podcast experiment into a novel, a published book that you can hold in your hands. With all of that out of the way, what do you say we get back into the story? Welcome once again to Life Without Consequence. Chapter 8. Nina. The Las Vegas Police Department took up 10 whole stories of the 70-story municipal tower downtown. And that didn't include the 8 stories above it that the city jail inmates called home. It did include 5 levels of parking garage, however, which is where Nina had been sitting for the past 30 minutes, trying to reapply her makeup without crying. She was upset, which was, if Nina was being honest, a little out of character. She and Parker fought a lot, and while she never enjoyed it in the slightest, a certain performative aspect to their quarrels had taken shape over the years, which she'd grown accustomed to. There was an order to which their blowouts began to follow, where an inciting incident would occur, usually Parker screwing up in some way. It was never huge. He'd do something she would disapprove of and then lie about it. Then he'd lie about lying. And this would go on and on until he'd dug himself into such a deep hole that he'd trip up, and she'd catch him. Nina would yell. Parker would yell back. In extreme scenarios, such as the night before, one of them would storm out, and they wouldn't talk for a day. When that happened, Nina would get a lousy night's sleep, lose her appetite, and feel horrible until one of them, usually Parker, reached out to apologize. Before she knew it, they were having fantastic makeup sex somewhere outrageous like the kitchen or the bathroom at Rusty's, forgetting that there had ever been an argument. It hadn't gone at all like that this time, and it left her a total wreck. He hadn't called. He hadn't shown up in the lobby of her tower. Instead, she'd gone out of her way, gone to his house, and instead of makeup sex, he'd basically slammed the door in her face. Nina knew she shouldn't have gone over there. Parker was the one who had lied, had put her reputation in jeopardy. She just didn't want to have to go into the station with this fight still hanging over her. And now, she was in even more of a state. Nina's attention was stolen by a low hum. Then the touchscreen that encompassed the entirety of her car's center console illuminated and read a text message to her.
Ramirez, where the fuck are you? The vein in LT's temple is doing that thing. I don't think he's fucking around.
It was from her partner, Detective Doug Logue. The two of them had been working a pretty cut-and-dry child abduction case. They'd found the missing kid and were in the final stages of pinning it on the father, who had blatantly done it. Nina thought she'd be stopping by the station, picking up Logue, and then heading off to get their confession. That series of events had been altered when she was informed that 2 federal agents had arrived unannounced, wanting to ask her some questions about the incident from the night before. The suicide at Parker's. She hoped it had nothing to do with what they found in Parker's basement. Sure, she was mad at him about it, but she hadn't intended him to suffer any real consequences. Nothing outside of being in her bad books for a few days. The last thing she wanted was to be put in a situation where she felt obligated to lie on Parker's behalf. It had happened before, and she'd gotten him out of some serious trouble, unfortunately at the cost of her own credibility. Nina wondered what else it could be about. Dead bums rarely came across her desk, and she doubted it would get the attention of the feds. When Nina finally picked herself up and walked inside, she found her partner leaned up against the front desk of their floor, looking about as much of a police stereotype as a person could. In one hand, there was a to-go cup with steam rising out of it, and in the other, his round fingers clutched some kind of deep-fried pastry. The man wore a grin of an older brother who knew his sibling was in deep shit. She waved him off before he could make any of the remarks she knew he'd been dying to make. "Get off it, Logue. LT's a big boy. He'll get over it." Logue took a bite from his glazed confection and responded, talking and chewing all at once. "They've been in there for a while. You might want to go in with a peace offering." Logue nodded at the drinks carrier with three steaming cups just like his, each with a small sachet tucked in next to it. Not even the police could get a hold of coffee anymore. So just like everybody else, they settled for caffeinated powders that purported to add the flavor of coffee. If you closed your eyes and thought hard enough about it, sometimes they actually did. "What do I look like, the fucking maid? What room are they in?" Nina asked. Logue pointed indistinctly in the direction of the hallway towards the conference rooms. "They're in C4. What's it all about, Ramirez? Peter Pan shit the bed again?" Peter Pan was the insulting nickname Logue often used when referring to Parker. Nina hated it, probably because it was so accurate. "I told you not to call him that," Nina snapped. People weren't shy about letting Nina know what they thought about her boyfriend. Sometimes it felt like they were desperate for Parker to prove them all right. Someone who made the kind of money Nina made didn't usually mingle with the people of Las Vegas. She let more of it slide than she should for the sake of keeping up appearances, but she hated hearing her partner constantly drag Parker. Logue snickered to himself through another mouthful of donut as Nina gave him the finger and disappeared into conference room 4. Two men in identical black windbreakers with identical haircuts sat across the table from Lieutenant Albie Ritter, or LT, as he was known around the station. She got the impression she was ending a silence that had been anything but brief. "Gentlemen, I am sorry to keep you waiting," she said, playing up her urgency and receiving a death stare from LT. The two agents only moved their eyes up to acknowledge her. Ritter was a military vet who wasn't satisfied with the amount of action he'd seen in the war and had entered the police force immediately following his term. Unfortunately for LT, his outstanding performance in the armed service helped to quickly propel him up through the ranks, and poor Albie Ritter had spent more time behind a desk than out on patrol where he really wanted to be. Ritter didn't care about law and order. He just hadn't gotten to shoot enough people during the war and was hoping to spend his days in Las Vegas thinning out the homeless population without repercussion. Now he spent his days taking out frustrations on his subordinates and making life as miserable as possible for new recruits or technicians. Even if her views had a slightly personal bias, Nina was part of a dying breed of cop that actually cared about right and wrong. Nearly every other employee of the LVPD took the job for the perks. "Detective Ramirez, nice of you to fit us into your busy schedule." The lieutenant's teeth didn't separate throughout the entire sentence. Nina knew there wasn't a single excuse that would make the man less angry, but she needed to offer him something. Relationship troubles just wasn't going to cut it. Nina remembered a call coming over the radio on her way to Parker's and hoped its abnormal nature might ease some of the tension. "Sir, sorry. I was assisting with an accident. Some crazy flipped his car on the 15. Says he hit a fridge, which, of course, is nowhere to be found now." Nina waited for someone to respond, but after receiving silence from all parties, decided to move on and pulled herself into a chair next to LT. Both of the agents were still as statues and looked as though they could have been brothers. She reached out to shake their hands, but neither of them returned the courtesy. "Okay," Nina said, feeling a sudden pang of guilt for leaving Lieutenant Ritter alone for so long with these federal mannequins. "I hear you gentlemen had some questions about the suicide from last night." The agent on the right produced a tablet, which he turned towards her, swiping as he did to display the mugshot of a sickly-looking old man.
Detective, could you tell us everything you know about this man?
The photo on the screen was of an older man, probably in his late 50s. He was clean-shaven and wore silver hair in a tight ponytail. Nina narrowed her eyes at the image, unsure of who she was looking at until it suddenly clicked.
Is this Mad Mike?
Nina asked, with her eyebrows raised in surprise. The two agents glanced at each other, but didn't speak. The suicide from last night, I mean. This is the guy? Nina pulled the tablet closer to get a better look.
I've never seen him look so... so...
Nina struggled to find an adjective that didn't make her feel as though she was speaking ill of a dead man.
He looks so clean.
Again, the only response from the agents was a glance at each other, as though they were passing telepathic notes. The agent on the right pulled the tablet away from Nina and swiped to another photo of the man, now looking like the unstable vagrant she'd seen whenever she'd visit Las Vegas. In the photo, he was disheveled, filthy, and digging through a trash can.
Yeah, she said in response to the image. That's the Mike I know.
The agent on the left raised his eyebrows and turned his ears slightly towards Nina, a gesture she interpreted as him wanting to know more.
He's a local bum. Screams a lot, drugs, alcohol, you name it.
He lived in a shipping container in Las Vegas. What's to know? Was he somebody important? There was a part of Nina that couldn't help but ask questions. Sadly, her questions would be ignored entirely.
Why did you call him that?
The agent on the left inquired. Nina furrowed her brow.
Mad Mike? I guess I never thought about it. It's just what we call him.
It had never occurred to Nina that Mike might not have actually been his name.
And when you say we,
the agent paused, swiping at the screen again. The image of Mike slid over to show two mugshots.
You are referring to Mr. Luderi and Mr. Cave.
Nina closed her eyes and sighed when she saw the photos. Parker had been arrested during a week in which he decided that a mustache might be a good look for him. It wasn't. He could barely grow a beard. The charge had been disorderly conduct, but anyone without that information would have easily assumed he was some kind of predator from this mugshot. Nina had nearly died when she arrived to collect him and Benj from lockup. Logue, who thought the whole thing was hilarious, had printed off what seemed to be an infinite amount of copies and tortured her with the photos for weeks. To this day, she would still arrive at her locker to find Parker's mustached face staring back at her. Nina composed herself and responded, "Yes, I am referring to Mr. Cave and Mr. Luderi."
And what is the nature of their relationship to the man you called Mad Mike?
Nina tried with all her might to prevent her eyes from rolling. She'd been through this before. The assumptions and insinuations. The previous spring, she'd taken Parker to a holiday party where a wallet had gone missing. Of course, he was immediately accused of having taken it. The whole scene escalated to Parker in cuffs and sat in the back of a squad car until the wife of the wallet's owner, naturally, the loudest of all the accusers, found it in her purse, where she had been keeping it the whole time. If something happened while Parker was nearby, he was always quickly implicated.
Relationship? There is no relationship.
Nina sat up straight in her chair, folding her arms and sucking her teeth as she tried to pass her own telepathic note of, "Go fuck yourself," to the robotic agents that sat across from her.
Detective? Were you aware of the illegal distillery Mr. Luderi and Mr. Cave had been operating on their property?
Nina had sat on the other side of more interrogations than she could count and knew exactly what the agent was doing. As long as he could affirm Parker's moral turpitude, they could pin whatever they wanted on him.
What the fuck does that have to do with a dead tweaker?
Nina snapped.
Ramirez!
Lieutenant Ritter barked, reining her in before her temper could get the better of her.
Answer the question.
Nina's nostrils flared, and she felt heat in her cheeks.
No,
she said as calmly and with as little attitude as she could manage.
Until last night, I was unaware of the distillery.
The agent on the right smiled.
It was the first time Nina had seen his facial expression significantly change. The agent on the left, the one who'd been doing the talking, stayed as stoic as when she'd entered the room. "So," he continued, "would you say it's reasonable to assume that Mr. Luderi may not have been entirely forthcoming with you about his involvement with the deceased?" Nina glanced at Ritter, who motioned for her to answer. "Yes," she said begrudgingly, "that would be reasonable." Nina tried to direct the anger she felt welling up inside of her at the agent and his self-satisfied smirk. But she knew he wasn't at fault. He might be an asshole, but Parker was the criminal, the liar. And once again, his actions were casting a dark shadow over her. The agent on the left reached for the tablet and swiped to a new photo. "Have you ever seen this item before?" he said in a cold, mechanical tone. On the tablet's screen was a photo of a small silver briefcase bearing the image of a snake eating its own tail. The small silver case she'd seen Benj leaving with the night before. For a split second, Nina froze. She froze, and the agent on the left clocked it. "No," she said with betraying confidence. "I've never seen that before in my life." It wouldn't have mattered what she'd said or how she'd said it. The agent noticed her hesitation and knew that she was lying. Nina didn't even know why she'd lied, a knee-jerk reflex to defend the reprobate she called her partner. "What exactly is it you think Parker and this mad Mike guy are involved in?" she asked. Nina knew the question was pointless. These two weren't going to tell her anything, but she still felt the need to try and find out precisely what kind of trouble she'd just made worse for Parker and Benj. Without warning, the agent on the left picked up the tablet and tucked it away in his case. They both stood up, suddenly seeming more casual, loose, more like humans than they had been throughout their questions. "I think this is all we need here. Thank you for your time," the agent on the right said as he buttoned his jacket. Nina wasn't satisfied and also stood up. "You didn't answer my question. What is Parker involved in?"
"Ramirez, drop it,"
LT interjected a second time. "But sir," Lieutenant Ritter rose to his feet, standing nearly an entire head over Nina.
"I said drop it," he growled,
immediately rescinding Nina's outburst. Ritter turned his attention to the agents and softened, even letting something that may have been considered a smile to creep onto his face.
"Gentlemen, please excuse the detective."
"Not to worry," the right agent said. "We appreciate your time and honesty."
The agent reached out and shook hands with Lieutenant Ritter, then offered his hand to Nina, who was in no position to refuse. She took his hand and the agent gave her the same self-satisfied smile as before. It made Nina want to explode. When the two agents had left the room, Lieutenant Ritter turned to her with fire in his eyes.
"What the fuck was that, Ramirez?"
He'd removed the gravel from his voice now, but his intent to intimidate hadn't diminished, even slightly.
"Sir, those men were out of line."
"Out of line to point out that stray mutt you keep is nothing but trouble?"
Nina looked for words that weren't there. She wondered if this was how Parker felt most of the time.
"What you do on your time is your business. I know where you come from," Ritter said accusingly. "But you better wipe your fucking shoes before you track anything from those streets onto my carpet. Do I make myself clear?"
Nina steadied herself and brought herself to attention. The lieutenant's metaphors were often witless, but his delivery was still soaked in military discipline.
"Yes, sir."
Ritter maintained eye contact for a second, daring Nina to show any signs of defiance. When he saw none, he turned and opened the door to reveal Detective Logue, who had been apparently eavesdropping the entire time. Ritter shook his head and walked past the rotund man, continuing to speak and expecting them to follow.
"I have you two working the Peterson case," he said.
It was a question, but neither of them responded. Nina had just been chewed out, and Logue was still trying to gauge the mood. Ritter stopped and turned to them.
"Yes?"
he said, clarifying his desire for a response.
"Yes, sir," Nina said. "We're on our way to pick up the father right now."
No, you're not, Ritter said calmly, then resumed walking down the hallway. Nina and Logue exchanged bewildered looks, then quickly fell in behind their superior.
But sir, Logue said, he's about to confess.
Then Pattinson and Conroy won't have any trouble coaxing it out of him.
A PA approached the lieutenant, handing him a file with stacked papers that required his signature. Ritter signed them and quickly handed them back.
Sir, Pattinson and Conroy are morons, Logue said brazenly. They're gonna fuck it up.
Nina stayed quiet. She had no pull with Ritter at that particular moment. And besides, she was fond of watching Logue dig his own grave.
You let me handle Pattinson and Conroy, Ritter said reassuringly. You two are gonna take over on Walgreens.
The pharmacy, sir? The pharmacy is a stakeout. You may as well give us traffic duty, Logue protested. Ritter lowered his tone again, leaning in a little closer to ensure nothing was lost in the distance between the two men.
Do you want traffic duty, detective?
No, sir, Logue responded.
Then you'll stake out the pharmacy, and you'll fucking love it. Am I clear?
Ritter turned to Nina, who hadn't spoken since leaving the meeting with the two agents.
Ramirez, am I clear?
Yes, sir, she responded without hesitation.
Good.
Ritter allowed himself a moment of content dominance over his subordinates, and then walked away without saying a word. Logue looked at Nina with his mouth hanging open.
What did you do in there?
Logue asked with an accusing tone.
Shut up,
Nina said, allowing her frustrations to finally surface.
Just shut up. Meet me at the car in 15 minutes.
Nina turned and walked away, doing her best to ignore the sound of Logue's voice calling after her.
I can't wait to spend 8 hours in a confined space with you, Ramirez.
When Nina got to the car, she felt like she wanted to break down.
Shit!
She yelled, slapping the steering wheel with both hands.
Shit! 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 Shit!
Once again, Nina had found herself watching life get more complicated because of a mess Parker had made. And she was beginning to feel like Parker's messes shouldn't be her responsibility to clean up anymore.
Chapter 9. Parker and Bench. Dallas, Texas was the closest thing to a city of the future America had seen since it became the future. It had been shaping up to be just that even before the war. The city and its governing bodies had seen the paradigm shift approaching and were one of the few places that realized the business-as-usual method of handling things wouldn't sustain them for very long. While everywhere else began to wither, Dallas prospered. They had started by phasing out cars. By 2035, the closest you could get to the city center in anything that ran on a fossil fuel was 3 miles. The only vehicles used were small, driverless electric carts provided by the city and scattered around for public use. The carts weren't free and definitely not cheap. But if you could afford to live in Dallas, you had no problem with cart fees. As interest in the city grew, so did the prices. They were the first city to fully adopt the high-rises, and when those caught on, they were the first to model the tower blocks after entire neighborhoods so residents never had to leave the building. These structures redefined the idea of a skyscraper while being the first to live up to the mental image the name suggested. Ben stood staring in awe at the distant towers that made up the Dallas skyline. Their highest stories climbed so high they disappeared into clouds and then reappeared on the other side. The buildings in Vegas were tall, but these had to be seen to be believed.
Yeah, this is great, said Parker, but we're not in Dallas.
He was right. They weren't in Dallas. They were in the middle of nowhere, surrounded by miles of empty plains that at some point had been lush and green. Now the only colors left were overcooked yellows and browns. A cold blue midnight sky sprawled above them, adorned with an infinity of glimmering stars. A stark difference from the thick brown smog that perpetually loomed over Las Vegas. They'd been, wherever they were, for nearly 20 minutes now. And the fact that they weren't actually in Dallas had been the only thing Parker could talk about.
Never mind the fact that his molecules had just been broken down and transported 1,200 miles in under a second, Parker was upset that something had been mislabeled. "It's like 60 fucking miles away," he continued complaining, pointing in the direction of the skyline. "I swear we're closer to Waco." In moments of frustration, Parker had a habit of making big deals out of little details, and today had been more than slightly frustrating for him. It wasn't so much the suicide he'd witnessed, the breakup, or even the nagging hangover that still hadn't entirely dissipated. By this point in the day, he'd mentally filed those things away to a section of his brain labeled trivial things that happened before teleportation. What was frustrating Parker now was the new times, the times after teleportation. Those were turning out to be a bit of a letdown. After the incident with the North Korean girl had shown them that the device could transport people, they hadn't wasted any time in trying it out on themselves. Due to the condition of the fridge, they were both still a little wary of exactly where the Vegas destinations might take them, so those were skipped in favor of places more interesting. And the first stop had been Cleveland. The blackout states had fascinated both Parker and Benj since they were children. Benj's father had a satellite photo of North America framed and hung in their dining room, which was still there to this day. As a kid, he would look at the glowing lights of nearby towns surrounding the inky blackness of the Midwest and let his imagination run wild. The idea of a place that survived without the use of electricity was unfathomable to him. Interstate segregation had progressed rapidly post-war, with luxuries like internet reserved for those far more well-to-do than the residents of Las Vegas. It was easy for happenings in somewhere even as close as Arizona to go unnoticed to those not online. Cleveland had been disconnected for nearly 60 years. To a hard-up resident of the Southwest, it may as well have been another planet. "It's cold there, right?" Parker had asked. Benj replied with something between a shrug and a nod that Parker interpreted as confirmation, prompting him to gather a few essentials. Benj had been quietly impressed with Parker's out-of-character display of forethought. The moment was short-lived, though, and instead of jackets, Parker appeared from the hallway closet with a bottle of their moonshine he'd hidden away for a rainy day. "Cold won't bother us now," he said, and then knocked back a mouthful of the cloudy liquid, snarling as it assaulted his esophagus. Parker offered the bottle to Benj, who initially declined, but quickly reconsidered and took a sip to calm his nerves after conceding to the reality of what they were about to do. They both leaned in close like tourists taking a picture of themselves. The image on the screen was washed out with the orange light from the cheap bulbs that illuminated their kitchen. Parker took one more sip from the bottle before Benj tapped the screen and sent them both to Cleveland, Ohio. In the blink of an eye, they were in the epicenter of the blackout. It didn't hurt, but the process wasn't without its own particular sensations. When it happened, Benj felt like he'd grabbed an electric fence, but without any of the pain. A faint tingle washed over his entire body, then quickly dissipated. There was a feeling of something that approached nausea, but never quite arrived there. It was memorable, and thankfully not so unpleasant that it would make either of them apprehensive about going through the process again. "Jesus Christ!" Parker exclaimed as he hopped up and down, shaking the tingle out of his fingers. "It feels like I got a handy from a ghost." Benj cocked his head to the side and narrowed his eyes in a look of confused disgust. "What? It does." For what felt like the thousandth time that day, Benj shook his head disapprovingly at Parker, who, as per usual, was unaware that he'd done anything to warrant the response. "What? Seriously, what'd I say?" Parker's voice had a metallic echo that drew attention away from lewd similes and on to where exactly they'd found themselves. Parker looked around the space and noticed he recognized their surroundings. "Are we in a shipping container?" The container was empty, except for a single dim construction lamp that illuminated the letters CLE-OH stenciled on the wall next to where it hung in the corner. The lamp gave off a similar warm orange glow to the lights in their kitchen, but the bulb's color was the closest to warmth the container offered. Sips of moonshine hadn't been quite as effective as Parker had hoped, and when he noticed he could see his breath, he cursed himself for not bringing the entire bottle along with them. The plywood boards beneath them sat unevenly on the metal floor and rocked under Benj's feet as he followed scuffs and footprints in the direction of the door. Even in the subpar, muted lamplight, He could see the chains and padlock. He gave the lock a tug, and the industrial echo of metal on metal hummed through the walls of the claustrophobic space. It was sealed tight, and they were going nowhere. Benj turned to Parker by waving his right hand into a fist and then tapping it against his left. Parker bounced on the balls of his feet and hugged his body, trying to keep warm. "Yeah, no shit, it's locked. What are we gonna do?" Benj deliberated briefly, then touched his thumb and fingertips to his lips, drawing them back across his cheek to his ear. "Home?" Parker responded, scanning their surroundings uneasily. "Yeah, this is kind of giving me the creeps." In less than a second, they were once again in the warmth of the kitchen. Parker shivered, trying to shake the sensation of teleporting away. "That," he said, taking a sip from the bottle, "is gonna take some getting used to." The movie theater of his overactive imagination was playing a double feature of atoms separating in slow motion. His atoms, specifically. In his mind, he was sat with a fistful of mental popcorn hanging inches from his mouth as he stared at the screen, wide-eyed and petrified by the images of molecules slowly being torn apart and then reassembled somewhere new. While Parker indulged in his thought, Benj scrolled through the list of locations stored on the device and noticed the abrupt change in smell between the kitchen and the place they'd just been. He'd never noticed how much their house smelled like garlic. In a typical functioning household that had regular meals sat around a dining room table, this wouldn't have been such an unusual thing to notice. In this house, though, home-cooked meals that weren't microwaved were a thing of legend. They just didn't happen. The smell brought back memories from his childhood. Dinner with his parents, and his younger brother. Benj realized how little he thought of them anymore, and how much that bothered him. Parker rubbed his palms together, still trying to bring some warmth back into them. "Okay, not a good start. Maybe this time let's try somewhere warm, yeah?" Benj flipped the device and showed Parker the screen. He'd selected Cairo. There was a lot of places to choose from. Benj recognized places like Los Angeles and Seattle right away, but couldn't immediately place the names of places like Tharsis and Behet Montes to locations on the globe. He remembered learning about the pyramids in school, and while they hadn't struck him with the same sort of dystopian curiosity as a place like Cleveland, he thought they were probably worth checking out. "Sure, fuck it. Sounds like a rager," Parker had said when he looked at the screen. Several more sips from the bottle had significantly diminished his instinctual sense of caution. "What's the worst that can happen? We wind up in another locked shipping container?" Once again, they leaned into the frame of the camera, both smiling despite not actually posing for a photo. "Oh, you gotta be fucking kidding me," Parker said as he rattled the chains of another locked container. The only indication that they weren't in the exact same shipping container was the crude stencil on the wall, this time reading KAY-RO. Benj scanned the room and noticed the floorboards were covered in sandy footprints that pointed to and from the door. He looked to Parker with raised eyebrows, then brought his right hand up to eye level with his fingers in the shape of a C, finishing the sign by tilting the shape downwards. Parker scoffed. "It's not so much weird as it is completely on brand for us. I don't know why I thought this would be remotely different from any of the other too good to be true things that have ever happened to us." Over the next hour, Parker and Benj tried half a dozen other destinations, and each time found themselves teleported into different shipping containers and storage units, each one chained and locked, all until Dallas. The container in Dallas had immediately been different. For a start, it wasn't empty. There was a folding table in the corner, under the light, and a shelf on the wall. "Well, I never thought I'd see the day that I got excited about a shelf," Parker said with over-exaggerated sarcasm. The shelf was old, and the brackets that were holding it up looked even older. On it were old spray cans, so worn by time the colors were no longer identifiable. Parker picked one up and gave it a shake. The rattle of the metal ball echoed inside the shipping container.
"I mean, I guess I never thought I'd see a man slit his own throat, you know? Or a fridge disappear, for that matter. Or a little girl teleport into my kitchen."
Before Parker's idle musings on the day's impossibilities and unlikelihoods could gain any real momentum, he was interrupted by the screeching sound of metal grinding against metal as Benj pushed the door of the container open. For the first time that night, they could actually explore the destination the device had sent them to. Kind of.
"I just don't know why you'd label something Dallas when it's not Dallas," I feel misled.
Benj noticed a car on a distant road heading towards them and waved in its direction with his thumb outstretched.
Hitchhike? At midnight in the middle of nowhere, Texas? No thanks.
Benj didn't care about hitchhiking. Or Dallas at all, really. It was the first time he'd been any significant distance away from the city since he was a kid. He was happy to just be somewhere new, and he wanted to go explore. The air felt crisp and clean. When they'd gotten out of the shipping container, both of them had taken huge, exaggerated lungfuls as if the experience could end at any second. Sadly, as refreshing as it was to be somewhere new, they were just in the middle of nowhere. After a few more minutes of looking at the city, Benj tapped the screen and sent them back to the kitchen, where Parker poured himself another drink and continued to complain.
"Well, this is amazing," he proclaimed sarcastically, clapping along with each syllable.
Benj rolled his eyes and tried to tune Parker out, focusing instead on the screen of the device and the list of destinations they could teleport to next. Parker complained a lot, so much so that it was almost just white noise to Benj. Today, though, it was though he'd somehow managed to change the frequency and turn up the volume. Benj had cut him a generous amount of slack because of the day he'd had, but by this point in the night, it was becoming unbearable. They were teleporting. A button had been pressed and their bodies were instantaneously transported from one location to another. Sure, the reality of it wasn't perfect, but it worked. He couldn't understand why there was anything to complain about. Parker picked up his glass and knocked what was left back in one with barely a frown. Swallowing the spirit was becoming significantly easier.
Great. We can teleport to locked shipping containers all over the world.
A slight slur was becoming audible in his words.
It's fucking incredible. Christmas and birthdays are ruined from now on. I mean, what do you get the guys who have every...
Parker's tirade was interrupted by Benj vanishing right in front of him. Thing. Quietly, Parker sat down at the kitchen table, feeling all of a sudden very unsure of himself. In the quiet, he wiggled his toes in his shoes and thought about his boots. Thinking about his boots made him think about Nina, and thinking about her made him think about being alone.
I didn't want to go anyway, he muttered as he poured himself another drink.
Chapter 10. Benj. Benj felt guilty about ditching Parker. He couldn't help it. That's just who he was. However, as he found himself once again on the wrong side of a locked door, he wasn't sorry he'd done it. Now 6 locked doors on, Benj could only imagine how insufferable Parker and his complaining might have become. Altogether that day, he'd been to 15 different places, and thus far, Dallas had been the only anomaly amongst the plethora of dead ends. Every location had been so diligently locked that Benj put the open container in Dallas down to sheer negligence. Mad Mike must have just forgotten to lock it. Maybe that's where he'd been coming from before they happened upon him in the yard last night. He wondered what was on the other side of those locked doors and what their strange neighbor had been doing with this incredible piece of tech. Thinking about how Mad Mike had ended his life made Benj believe that maybe it was a good thing he and Parker couldn't get out of these places. It was unfathomably frustrating, though. They'd been given the means, but not the total access. The idea wasn't lost on him that maybe they were being watched. After all, these places were deliberate landing pads for each destination. There was a system in place, and it seemed elaborate enough to assume that it wasn't just being maintained by one single 7-foot-tall meth addict. Benj checked the containers, storage lockers, and even one room in England that looked like a single-car garage, and didn't find any blatant evidence of surveillance. As he went further down the rabbit hole, Benj tried not to get his hopes up for something other than locked, empty rooms. While those were the only things he'd been able to find, he still couldn't help crossing his fingers right before he tapped the screen and teleported away to the next destination. The feeling of teleporting was becoming less and less jarring. What had initially made Benj feel like he was about to turn out his stomach had become a brief shiver that he barely even noticed. He'd begun to grow accustomed to the warm orange glow of the construction lamps that were hung in the various containers and storage units he'd been finding himself in.
Each one made a continuous electrical hum that was consistent from one location to the next. This new room, however, was dark. Very dark and very quiet. There was no light attached to the wall. No uneven floorboards beneath his feet. This space gave off an entirely different feeling. Before Benj had a chance to panic, he was robbed of all of his balance by the entire room suddenly lurching and sending him crashing to the floor. Allowing pessimism to take the wheel, Benj caught himself wondering if this was a symptom of using the device, if he'd teleported too many times and fried his central nervous system. There was a shooting pain just above his right eye and a brief flash of white as his head collided with something on the way down. As Benj lay on the floor, feeling a thin trail of blood that began to drip across his forehead, he noticed his cheek was pressed against carpet. Rolling onto his back, he looked up and saw a small, circular window that allowed a beam of white moonlight into the gloom. The swaying sensation continued, quickly transforming from foreign to familiar. As a child, he'd felt it before, unreasonably terrified of sharks out in the middle of Lake Mead with his father. He was on a boat. His eyes began to adjust, and Benj was able to make out the layout of a cabin, a chest of drawers to his right, and a bed directly in front of him. In the moonlight, Benj could make out the silhouette of a lamp on a bedside table and used it as a target to crawl towards. After managing to put a dent in his shin bone, thanks to the protruding bed frame, Benj eventually found his way to the small metallic button, which depressed with a satisfying click and flooded the room with the familiar warm orange glow. Squinting through the sudden brightness, Benj was able to see that the cabin he'd teleported into was quite lavish, decorated in regal reds and polished wood grain surfaces. All of the fixtures were plated gold, the lamp, the round porthole window, even the door handle. A stark difference from the industrial settings of the shipping containers he'd spent most of his night teleporting into. Everything was dressed in an even layer of dust. It had been quite some time since someone had been in this room. Immediately, he decided Parker needed to see this, and reached into his pocket for the device. By this point in the night, Benj was handling the thing with the same nonchalance as any high-rise teenager, tapping the screen and opening the app like he was checking one of the many attention-demanding social networks. It was when Benj moved his thumb over the send button, something terrible suddenly occurred to him. In his rush to escape Parker's incessant complaining, he'd overlooked the fact that he could only travel to places that were stored in the device, and his house in Las Vegas wasn't one of them. A bolt of panic forked through Benj and presented itself in the form of fight-or-flight movement, causing him to stand up and rush to the cabin door. He stopped with fingers wrapped around the golden handle and tried to grasp at some more rational thinking. This was bad. Very bad. But he wasn't completely screwed. With a slight twinge of embarrassment, Benj walked back to the bed and sat down. It was soft. So soft that he never entirely stopped sinking into it. He wondered how someone could sleep in it without the constant feeling of being completely swallowed by the bed and suffocating. Just like Parker dealt with stress by focusing on small, frustrating details, Benj's mind dealt with it by leading him to harrowing worst-case scenarios. Drumming on his legs, Benj tried to assess the situation he was in. He was on a boat in Long Beach, California, and he could travel between there and his previous stop, a shipping container in Kazan, Russia, which was locked. He might have been able to get off of the boat, but that still put him 5 or 6 hours by car away from Las Vegas. And it wasn't like he had his interstate passport handy to get across the border, even if he could find a way to get there. Benj stood up and began to pace the tight space between the dresser and door, trying to devise a plan that didn't involve walking home. Several half-baked ideas passed through his mental periphery before he remembered that there had been another Las Vegas destination saved to the device. One had destroyed a fridge, but the other had passed the case test before being overlooked. Benj took a deep breath, and then, with a renewed sense of caution toward teleportation, tapped the screen and left the cabin behind. He felt the tingle and waited with his eyes still scrunched closed for something terrible to happen. But nothing terrible came. Wherever he was, it was cool and quiet. He could feel the artificially cold breeze of an air conditioner blowing across the back of his neck. Through the slight translucence of his closed eyelid, he could tell that there was no construction lamp. This room was also dark. Slowly, Benj opened his eyes, and on a day where he had seen the impossible become reality, he still had to pinch himself to be sure he wasn't dreaming upon seeing where the teleporter had taken him. Artwork for Life Without Consequence was provided by Daniel Sewell. You can find him on Twitter at writer Dan Sewell. That's DanSoule. Music for this episode was provided by me, Davey Francis. You can find more of my music at DaveyFrancis.com.